notes to take.
Okay, here's something that might this might be, it's in the topic we're talking about.
But it makes you remember things better. Yeah. I understand how that
I'm going to draw from the onion after I get the history out here for something. And that is that in response to this oil embargo and this shortage of oil and high prices, et cetera, we just mentioned all the things like attempts to make better cars or buy better cars or to try to seek alternative fuel sources. And a lot of it has to do not only with the shortage of fuel, but it's the case of what a big inflation impact it causes. Higher oil prices cause higher everything. Salaries and higher home costs. And therefore, how does Nixon in 73 through 74 cope with this runaway inflation, potential runaway?
He puts a stop on price raises.
Wage and price controls, just like it's World War II FDR type thing. Wage and price controls are put into place. When he leaves office, or rightfully leaves office, he stops it. And Ford inherits this problem and doesn't solve it. But one of the things that Ford tries to do is, let's attack inflation through voluntary means. Rather than government force, let's everybody voluntarily spend less and live worse. And we'll do it through a campaign called WIN. W-I-N, the buttons that everybody will run is whip inflation now. You wear your WIN button and you don't spend as much. Did we whip inflation now?
No.
No, we did not.
We don't want to live crappily.
Boy, that's where I'm going with this thing of the onion. And so Ford does not conquer from 74 to 75 the inflation problem. Who's the next president?
Carter.
And Carter has to face the inflation problems and fuel shortages. We find in 1979 there was another oil mysterious cutoff going on. It's not Arab nations. They can't figure out who it is. Many people think it's the oil companies themselves on purpose cut supply for the purpose of forcing the price up. And it takes another leap in 79. So whether it's a conspiracy by the oil companies or not, there is another oil crisis in 1979. Some people relate it to the hostage crisis because that's going on over there at the same time. And with that new increase in oil prices comes an even greater rise in inflation during the Carter years. And Carter tries his best to convince people we just have to learn to be less wasteful and more less prolificate, a lot more willing to live at a lower lifestyle. And the Reagan campaign in 1980
says... How's that different from Ford's?
Not a lot different. Not a lot different. And the Reagan campaign against Carter in the 1980 election is built on the idea that Americans should not have to live with less. We're America. There's lots of oil all over the world. There's oil in Alaska. There's oil under the ground. What we need to do is get in the business of helping developers find more oil rather than tell everybody they have to live with less. And that was part of the campaign of 1980 was which direction we're going to go with the learn to be savers, we're going to be environmentally safe and pay more for fuel and drive better fuel mileage cars, or are we just going to be Americans that put the top down and drive that old big Lincoln car and enjoy it? And that's why in the Onion there is a campaign thing about Carter on one side and Reagan on the other on fuel crisis shortage. And the Carter response is, let's talk about better mileage. And Reagan's argument is, let's kill the bastards, meaning the Arabs that don't sell us enough oil. Which is not what he really said, but in essence it was what he really said in the debate. And he won. Reagan won the election because people were far more into relaxing and living better than cutting back like Carter said. And I can even tell you my experience. In the summer of 1980, I was taking a graduate course program up at the University in Fayetteville. And part of the Carter plan was to tell all public buildings, all universities, etc., had to hold their thermostats at 80 instead of 75. 80 degrees in the summer in a public building where there's no wind blowing or anything.
Wait, who
every
said
unbathed
this?
Person can be smelled all over that whole university library. And I was thinking what I was studying. I'm a liberal. I hope Carter wins. On the other hand, if Reagan wins this election, it'll feel a lot better next time.
Who, Carter said this? What state was Carter from?
Georgia.
Georgia?
It would be so heat.
Because California is different, like, there's some states where you don't need air conditioning.
Yeah. But that tells us a little something from 73 to 80. How did America respond to oil, the oil crisis, the shortage of fuel? And we just did not like the idea of being told that we have to learn to live with less. Of course, you can see where we are now. Since that time, even more dependent upon greater imports of oil from the Middle East.
What happens when you light an oil field on fire? Does that just burn all? It doesn't deplete the entire source.
It'll burn as long as there's oil under the ground shooting up into it. Do you remember, are you guys old enough to remember when Saddam did that to the Kuwaiti oil fields?
That's, I was...
When he left, he lit all those wells on fire, and we had to come in with professional oil fire putter outers and put every one of them out. And in fact, the company that did it and successfully did so was led by a guy named Red Adair, A-D-A-I-R. And he's been in the business of putting out oil fires from way back to the 1950s and 60s. His company has been. And there's a movie that came out in 1968 with John Wayne in it, which is all about that, putting out oil fires, called something, Hell Brigade, or the Hellfighters. The Hellfighters with John Wayne is about this. Well, anyway, that's where I wanted to go with the oil business. 84 is the 1972 election. Who's running in the 1972 election? Against?
McGovern.
Yeah, George McGovern. And George McGovern was by far the most left-leaning, radical candidate the Democrats have ever run. And they lost big time as a result of it. Nixon won hugely over it. Who was McGovern's running mate the first few days?
Crazy guy.
Thomas Eagleton, because of depression, had shock therapy earlier in life.
Records? How does those become public? Do medical records, when you enter politics, does that become public records?
I guess so.
Don't they have to sneak into that?
Well, it wasn't the Democratic camp that revealed it. It was somebody else on the outside. I think it was reporters that, I don't know how they came up with it. But it tells us something about the age. I mean, FDR in a wheelchair, people don't even know that's going on. And here's something in this guy's past that's revealed.
Shock therapy and not being able to walk or
anything. He wasn't still continuously taking it.
Okay.
Well, anyway.
I was just saying they weren't the same.
The Democrats themselves dumped Eagleton and replaced him with who?
Schreiber.
And what does that tell you? I'm going to use this to link into another discussion here. What does that tell you about McGovern's and the party's ability to pick people?
Not great.
Yeah, that they did not do their research to pick the second in command, the heartbeat away from presidency, that well. And then after they did, when trouble occurred and he claimed he was going to back him 1,000%, he dumps him. This tells us a little bit about Bush and Quayle. Who is Dan Quayle?
Utah.
Oh, that, but...
The vice president?
The vice president for Bush the Elder twice. Mm-hmm. Well, not once. He didn't get reelected.
Yeah.
But he ran twice. Mm-hmm. He was his running mate in 1988. And in 1992, because Quayle had made so many dumbass remarks, the party wanted to dump him. And Bush said he would not dump him. He was going to keep him on. Why?
What kind of remarks?
Because neither of them could spell
Spanish. This was a comment that was sincerely made. He said that he was planning to go on a Latin American tour soon, so he thought he better brush up on his Latin. And everybody laughed, and he didn't.
Where was he from?
Indiana. He replaced Birch Bayh, took Birch Bayh's seat.
Douche. And he spelled potato wrong?
Yeah.
Now, I don't attack him on that, because I can't spell anything with an E on the end of envelope.
But
developer.
Is that what I'm thinking of?
Yeah. If you pluralize potatoes, you do put an E, right?
Yes. Well,
if you singularize it, the E falls off.
Yeah.
He didn't take the E off. But I don't have any problem with that, because develop envelope, I don't know whether it's E's or not. So I don't attack him for that. But that was a problem. Another one of his comments was, the Earth is the greatest planet in the world. I've probably said things like that too, but anyway. But the point being made is that Quayle did not look all that sharp, and so when a lot of people argued that when he ran for re-election, Bush should have dumped Quayle and got a more attractive candidate. And the reason Bush did not was, he said that when McGovern dumped his candidate, dumped his running mate, it made him look like a bad choice of people. He does not want. And there was even a movement to dump Quayle early on in the first election, and he wouldn't do it then either, because he says it suggests that I'm not a solid administrator with my choices. You got to back your choices.
Is that what George
George of Governing claimed he was
going to younger, George Bush the Younger. I said we're going to Iraq, so we'll never.
That's one thing we know to be true, that George Bush the Younger has been extremely loyal to his people for a long time. And do we know of anybody that's been shoved out by Bush?
Yeah.
Besides Harriet Myers?
No. Well.
And he kind of made it look like she did that on her own.
Rumsfeld?
Yeah. He didn't really ask him.
He didn't.
No, Rumsfeld did it on his own. So Bush has been quite loyal. Look at how long he stood behind Gonzales. There's a third party candidate in 72. Who is he?
David?
No, not yet. Not Nader yet. Well, here's a man who back in 63, stood in the doorways of the Alabama University.
Oh, Thomas.
That's Arkansas.
Wallace, I mean.
George Wallace. He's famous for the quote, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever.
Racist governors, I can't give him straight.
So he tried to run in 68 as a third party. It's online here. 68 is when he ran as a third party candidate. In 72, he tries to come back and get the Democratic nomination. Fails to get it. Stays loyal to the party, but even though he stays loyal to the party in 72, where do southern states go?
Republican.
Yes.
Yeah.
And why?
Because it's the new age.
Yeah, it's the new South, where they're no longer loyal over civil rights, but with the liberalism McGovern was, they're not going to vote for him anyway.
Yeah.
And he tried to get the Democratic in 72?
Yes. Now, why Wallace is on here, I mixed up my ears, is that as he attempts to become a Democratic candidate again, he is shot.
Yeah.
And permanently paralyzed from the waist down. And it is said that the sufferings that he felt from his paralysis made him reflect back on how he had treated black people in Alabama. And went to black churches, repented, and said that if you'll reelect me as governor, I will support your concerns rather than fight you like I did in the past. And he did. And by and large, the black community re-elected him over and over with the belief that this is a sincere, changed man. And I think he was, too.
Who shot him?
Arthur Brimmer. In a shopping center in Largo, Maryland.
Was it a political thing, or just... Oh.
So in 87, Nixon wins. Huge margin. And the irony is that this huge victory for Nixon corresponds to also even more seats for the Democrats in Congress. Now the Watergate affair.
Yay.
Number 88. Why does the Watergate annex or complex to the Howard Johnson Motor Hotel in Washington, D.C., which, by the way, before we go any further, Monica Lewinsky and Bob Dole were both living in the Watergate Hotel when the Lewinsky scandal broke.
No, the hotel part or the apartment building?
Yeah, the apartment part.
I wonder if those are nice and I don't think that.
But why was the break-in... What's in Watergate? What were they breaking into? The Democratic National Committee's headquarters. And they're breaking in for what purpose?
Learn things about what they're doing, their strategy for the election.
To get a landslide victory.
So do you have to win a quiz bowl tournament so damn bad that you break into their high school's quiz bowl room and steal all their strategy plans and secrets and questions?
You do when your SAT test-taking room has Southside quiz bowl champions all over the walls.
Well, they are the champions this year, aren't they?
I really think that would mess your head.
Well, that's the Nixon attitude. The Nixon attitude was, we lost a close one in 60. We won a close one in 68. We won a landslide in 72. And so that's why the Nixon camp did what it did. That's why it made sure that McGovern was the candidate by pulling dirty tricks on all the other potential Democratic candidates. And it's also why they break into the Watergate annex.
What number are we on?
88, top of the
page. We've never gotten an 88.
You can't talk like that.
Ours goes from 87 and goes to 19.
Well, I think there's more.
They're so close.
How did they actually break in?
Well, then I can't think and talk at the same time. Let me find those sheets and then I'll come back to you.
Okay.
88 through, what is this? Here's a bunch of cool stuff.
I bet that goes all the way to the end of the
time.
Yeah, up to 76. Why they broke in, or how they broke in? Well, it comes back to 89 here, and that is, let's talk about creep and the plumbers. The plumbers was a nickname given to a group of people within the White House whose job was to stop White House leaks. Meaning people within the White House would leak to the press damaging information. If anybody needs more, he's laying them right over there. And the plumbers became a convenient group not only to plug White House leaks, but to also do little secret espionage stunts that need to be done for Nixon. Nixon had what he called his enemies list. These were, do you have four?
Not with me today.
Democrats, government officials, liberals, people that Nixon believed were out to get him, so he had these people listed up so that they could be neutralized back. And the classic way of doing it was through the dirty tricks campaigns of dropping innuendo or accusations or writing letters to the editor of the paper to try to neutralize the impact of somebody that was a danger to them. So the plumbers were used for that purpose. They were put into action by committee members of CREEP, the Committee to Re-elect the President.
Now, is that an official thing?
Yeah, that was a committee put together to re-elect CREEP. To re-elect Nixon.
Did they call themselves CREEP?
Yeah, they called themselves CREEP. Here's the part about this that makes it kind of interesting was, prior to 1973, if you donated money to a presidential campaign, there were no laws that designated how much you could give or how much you couldn't give or where that money had to come from. There was no laws demanding record keeping.
To re-elect
the president.
Why are there two E's?
Committee thought it would be cute. I don't know.
CREEP? Incredible.
Committee to re-elect
the president. So a lot of campaign money that came into the Nixon campaign, a lot of it from milk producers, International Telephone and Telegraph Company, Exxon Oil, big businesses that wanted to get Nixon re-elected so that they could see a Republican drag his feet on regulations and enforcement of things. That money, since it didn't have to be front and center as to where it came from, was used for a number of other things besides the re-election. A lot of it was laundered through Mexican banks so that it could come back and be used to pay people to break into the Watergate Hotel.
So there were restrictions at this time?
1971, the Federal Election Committee does set up some rules about donations, but they're so lax, that's why after Watergate there's more. And so E. Howard Hunt was hired by Gordon Liddy to pick some Cuban exiles and some other people to do the break-in. And it was this laundered Mexican money that was used to pay them to do the break-in as well as pay their bail when they got caught to get out of jail.
Wait, some Cuban exiles to do the break-in?
To do the break-in, yes.
I think you should just comment that the reason we know all this stuff is because of Bob Rubin.
Well, that's coming up. It's coming up here in the page here. The night they broke in, they put tape on the doors so the door wouldn't lock behind them and they could get back out. So while they're in rustling around trying to find files and things, they need something from their van. So I think the flashlight or something. They go back to get to the van. When they come to the door, they find...
They were so getting coffee and donuts.
They saw that the tape had been removed and the door was locked as they were to go out. So you know, that should have been a clue that somebody knows somebody's in there, but they figured, oh, well, we better tape the lock back again. So they just retaped the lock, went to the van, got the material, and came back in. Well, Frank Wills, the building guard, he saw the tape on the first time and pulled it off. He should have got a hint, too, when he pulled the tape off. There's a reason for it. Comes back and finds tape on it a second time.
God.
There must be somebody in the building. So it's not just Forrest Gump calling to rat on everybody.
It's over the lock so it can't go into the hole.
Oh, okay. I've used that many times since then when I don't have my key with me.
That's not safe.
But anyway, he inspects and finds them and arrests them. And irony of irony, 10 years later, security guard Frank Wills uses the tape method to break in somewhere else to rob something and gets caught.
That is hilarious.
It has to be a cartoon. That's what it's like a cartoon.
Think of political cartoons in the 70s, how good they must have been. They go to trial, and they appear before the federal court judge, John J. Sirica, who is a Republican. But Sirica finds it strange that these people want to break into the Democratic headquarters. He's not your usual burglar.
J is the initial?
Yes, middle initial J. John, middle initial J, S-I-R-C-A. So Sirica hits all of them with extremely excessive bail, mainly to see if they'll get somebody pays it. And sure enough, somebody does. And that's that laundered money we're talking about that is bails all these people out. Just happening to be monitoring the regular, you know, court trials. The reporters go to court trials to see who gets arrested, etc. Woodward and Bernstein, two reporters for the Washington Post, happen to be at Sirica's court that day. And when they see where it was broken in, how high the fine or the bail was, the fact that it's paid by somebody makes them quite curious to start checking who paid this bail and why to get these people out.
Was Bob Woodward a Republican then?
Yes.
Do you not have to say who you are before you pay someone's bail?
He's not a Jew.
I don't know.
No.
Or with their invasion of privacy? Drop a bag of money.
That would be like an invasion. Like I'm trying to bail out my prostitute. I don't have to tell you my name.
Well, the main story here, and if you want to see this in a good movie with Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman, it's All the President's Men, which is a play on what old book title?
King.
About him.
About the
it's a play on the
Huey Long, yeah. Louisiana.
I never noticed that connection. But
are you serious?
No, that's really good.
But the name changing.
What? I never noticed. I just always associate with the name of the movie.
Well, anyway, what happens is by doing a lot of investigating, they not only find out who paid the bail, but where the money came from, the fact that it was laundered, and that's when they uncover the Dirty Tricks campaign. They also find out about the breaking in of the Ellsberg psychiatry office. So all of the Watergate knowledge comes to the forefront through their investigative journalism, and the Washington Post is pursuing it. And the Nixon administration is denying every accusation, saying the Washington Post is lying, and it's a struggle. And to some degree, what is the Post? They're trying to outscoop the Times, right?
Yeah.
Because the Times had first broken the knowledge on something I forgot to mention earlier during the war. What was that?
The Pentagon Papers.
It was mailed to them.
But they got it first.
It was an investigative reporting.
And the Post had all the Post could do was reprint the next day what the Times printed on the Pentagon Papers. Now it's in reverse. Post is running ahead of it. New York Times is reprinting what the Post is showing.
How can a newspaper reprint another newspaper's thing? Can't they just like say?
As long as it's, if they give credit and reference to where it comes from, and it's the day later, that helps the Post because it helps publicize how important that they're leading the nation's story.
And why would the Times print it?
Because it sells New York Times papers.
Yeah, but a day late.
That's
okay.
Like if you see it break on Fox and the next day CNN covers it, do you get pissed at CNN for being late?
I see.
No, let's get pissed at Fox for being.
Well, in the uncovering of information, the first two people to face prosecution is H.R. Haldeman, Bob Haldeman, and John D. Ehrlichman, who are White House underlings, White House staff people. And I think Haldeman, one of them was chief of staff. I don't know what the other one's role was.
Which of these people?
All the names I'm going to mention now are White House staff people who are involved in the, not much the break-in, but in the conspiracy to cover up the break-in. The break-in took place in June of 1972. 5 days after the break-in, people are talking to Nixon about it. Nixon did not order the break-in, didn't even know it was going to happen. They were just freelancing on their own. But after they got caught, that's when they went to Nixon. In fact, as people were on trial, one of the first of the revealed White House tapes that we'll talk about later shows Nixon on the tape talking to John Dean, saying, can we raise enough money to get these people to stay quiet? Will $1 million do? So for Nixon to later say he had no knowledge of the whole cover-up, the break-in, yes, he may not have known about, but he's instrumentally at the beginning in the cover-up by authorizing on the tape paying these people off to stay quiet. And as it turns out, Dean can kind of see where everything's going, is that he's going to be set up to be the patsy fall guy for everything. So Dean goes to the court and just says, I'll tell all. Some of the information came early to Sirica also by one of the break-in people themselves, James McCord. While the others remained silent, McCord wrote a secret letter to Sirica saying, if you search, you'll find there's connections to the...
Who said this?
James McCord.
Who did he send the letter to?
Sirica. He was one of the people arrested for breaking in. Where Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Dean, these are people who didn't do the break-in, but they're involved in the White House with trying to cover it up. So it's Dean's admissions which bring to light most of what's going on in the White House, which is why everybody hated Dean so much. Dean's still around today, yeah. He interviews quite often on talk shows about the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
He's written a book lately called Conservatives Without a Conscience.
Were McCord and Sirica, they're the ones arrested?
McCord is one of the break-in people arrested. Sirica's the judge.
So Sirica
is the one that McCord appeared before.
That's not Sirica.
That I is wrong. The I is a typo. It should be just Sirica. So that's my misspelling here. John Mitchell was the attorney general who was involved in gathering funds and paying off break-in artists. Mitchell's wife was an alcoholic who would get tanked up and go to reporters and start talking all about all this stuff. And that's one of the reasons she was hushed up and Mitchell was removed from being the attorney general position. L. Patrick Gray was the assistant leader of the FBI under Hoover. Gray was pressured by Nixon to not investigate the Watergate break-in. We now know the second half of the story as of what, last year?
Yes.
That when L. Patrick Gray refused to or allowed the investigation to stop so that what Nixon's underlings did didn't come out, Hoover was dying at this time. And so he was not really in charge of things. Gray was. Who thought he was going to replace Hoover as the next FBI director?
Gray?
Felt. Mark Felt.
Mark Felt what?
Thought he was going to become the new Hoover. Thought he was going to become the director of the FBI because of his long years of service. Felt was passed over instead. I don't know who became it, but it was he got denied the appointment. So what did Mark Felt do in revenge to Nixon for not appointing him?
He became Deep Throat.
And he fed the information we needed to know to whom?
Mm-hmm.
Bob Woodward. And Bob Woodward, when they reported this and when he wrote his books about it, all he referred to him was his Deep Throat and promised he'd never reveal Deep Throat's name until either A, he gets permission, or Deep Throat dies. And so from 1973 until what, last year?
He's still alive, though.
Yeah. Why did he reveal him last year?
Because he has, like, Alzheimer's or something. Something's wrong with
gang stuff.
He himself said, I'm admitting I am Deep Throat. And when Woodward spoke with him, he wanted to make sure he was lucid and in his right mind, and he could tell that yes, he was aware of the fact that he's doing, but he forgot most of his memory, but he is actually aware of the fact that he is Deep Throat and he's revealing. And the reason his family talked him into revealing who it was so he could write a book and sell the book to make enough money to send their kids to college.
Aww.
So let's cash in on Granddad.
Why do you
here.
Think
well,
that
he's well, he's still sellable here.
Do you really think he thought his identity would be revealed ever? Why would he pick that name?
The name itself.
I know why he picked. I just am wondering why he would pick that name if he thought. Because now his name's
I don't think he chose the name.
Oh,
I think
okay,
that
that's
was,
what I was
that was Woodward's
okay.
choice. Yeah. And we don't need to tell the young children here what the name. Okay. Right.
It was the first one with the story.
All the connotations.
Yeah, there was a movie at the time. There was a Cornell film at the time. Call that.
What was his name?
Mark Felt.
And who wrote the book? Which one of these? Written
names.
All the President's Men? Woodward and Bernstein.
Who came up with the name Dietzel and all that stuff?
I thought that's
what Woodward himself used it. Apparently, Mark Felt had fed Woodward information prior to this time on other FBI matters for stories, always on the promise that he would remain anonymous. And so because he had, Woodward had been so good about not telling where he got the information, that's why Felt was willing to tell him more about Watergate. So Deep Throat's revealing of this information, yes, it was. He saw the Watergate affair and the Watergate cover-up to be a great crime that needed to be exposed. He saw a presidency that had become excessively too powerful and needed to be brought down. That's true. But the other part, the bigger part is, they dissed me by not making the FBI director, so I'll fix their wagon. That was the feeling.
And what was he in that? I mean, was he, and this Patrick Gray was the assistant, and but he...
He was running it for Hoover, who was not in capacity.
But Mark Felt was close to being assistant?
Another assistant, I guess, another big time... Holder.
The book was called All the Presidents?
And they wrote a follow-up book called The Final Days, which addressed up to the days of the resignation of Nixon.
They have 1,000 copies.
Well, look at 90. From late 72 into 73, as the Post begins to pursue more and more of these things, the Senate starts to take up, the House and Senate both, to take up efforts to investigate. Oversight committees are formed. And throughout 1973, there are interrogations and investigations as to what, to use Howard Baker's comment, what did the White House know and when did they, what did the President know and when did he know it in regards to the break-in. Sam Ervin, a North Carolina senator, headed up the Senate Investigating Committee in the summer of 73. I was working a part-time job delivering school supplies for the Portsmouth school system. We're driving around in the school truck listening to the radio. I remember looking on the radio too, hoping to get to be a teacher in the system someday, that the Senate revealed that there was the head of the Federal Aviation Agency was testifying and had revealed that there were tapes, secret tapes made by Nixon that had everything we needed to know about Watergate and everything else on those tapes. So this Alexander Butterfield is the one that tells the Senate, if you can get a hold of those tapes, we can find out a lot more about what happened. Now, why was Nixon making voice-activated tapes in the Oval Office?
This is a weirdo.
Actually, Johnson did it too, but Nixon said that the reason he did it was because he wanted to leave records for his library, and that writing was becoming old-fashioned and that modern technology taping was much more efficient. It'd be easier to keep all the conversations that took place for compiling later. But the point was, he had every conversation that went on, things that he did not want revealed on there also. Some of it was because a lot of the people on the inside knew these tapes existed, so that they'd be careful not to say too much but that he's got them on tape saying it too. It was kind of for blackmailing purposes against others. So what happens is the Senate wants these tapes turned over, and they ask how many tapes are there. And Nixon admits that there anything relevant to the Watergate affair, there are 7 tapes. And others say there's 9. And Nixon says there's only 7. So there's a dispute about whether there are 7 or 9 tapes that exist. Under the pressure of the courts, Nixon finally decides he will make transcripts of those 7 tapes and turn them over to the investigating committee. Not going to give the tapes, they're going to just give transcripts. And in the transcripts that are turned over, there are large deletions. There's one portion where there's 18 minutes of information. Well, that's after the tape itself comes, but there's 18 minutes of a tape that's totally missing. What shocked many wasn't so much the deletions of information, but the fact that quite often in the transcripts you would see where they're talking about hippies doing a protest rally in New York and how we could hire Teamsters to go beat them up. They would have, we could blankety blank those blankety blank hippies, we'll use the Teamsters on them, and you can all imagine what words are being used. And the tapes, transcripts, it just had expletive deleted, expletive deleted. So that was the first shocking thing, was that our president and his officials spoke in such gutter language in Parliament?
And you can't be pardoned for a crime you're not convicted for, right?
Apparently you can.
Continue with the story.
As he was. Well, the courts are not impressed with the transcripts, and so through further action, they pressure him to release the tapes themselves. So those 7 tapes come over, and then the court appoints people to listen to these tapes, and that's when they find that there are these big gaps of information on there. One gap, the 18-minute gap, when asked what happened, Nixon tried to explain it this way, that his secretary, Rosemary Woods, in the transcribing of the start and stop the tape, hit pause, stop, type, stop, that she may have that the pause button was on 1 foot and the start button was over, and she may have accidentally hit the wrong button and hit record rather than pause and actually accidentally erased those 18 minutes.
Oops.
And they asked to see how that could have been possible, and it turns out that the foot control button and the hand control button was like this far apart. But she'd had to have been like this to have made the mistake. And they call it the sliding into third base pose of Rosemary Woods on the transcription of the tapes. So, who knows what happened on the 18 minutes.
Now, are those called the White House transcripts?
The White House tapes, White House transcripts. The so-called missing White House tapes. Well, as the court is still not satisfied with what they've received, they put greater pressure on Nixon to release the other 2 tapes, which he has now verified does exist, but is declaring that he will not reveal the final 2 tapes because they have so much concerning national security and Middle Eastern policy that will endanger troops and spies in the field. Therefore, he declares he has executive privilege to deny the release of these tapes. Anybody a Star Trek fan? Okay. In Voyager.
I'm not a Voyager fan.
But you'll know what I'm asking about. Who is the tall, appropriately shaped Borg chick?
Appropriately shaped.
You
probably don't know any of the names very well.
Well, she's right here in number 90, 7 of 9.
Oh,
yeah, that's right.
That's
it, yeah.
Yeah.
Because she beats up that one dude in that one episode.
Now, is that an accident? Or is that somebody thought that'd be cute to name her
then?
Well, as the summer folds into 1974, through court pressure, the court case Nixon versus the U.S. 1974, as well as further demands by the Senate Investigating Committee, Nixon is pushed to finally reveal or release those final 2 tapes. But something that happened before I get to that is in 91. In September of 73, well, let's back up a bit. Something to make this make sense. Something the Senate did during these investigations, which would come back to haunt Clinton later, is the creation of a new office called the Special Prosecutor. It was a job created by the Congress, but its appointment would go to the presidency. So it's a mixture of executive and legislative branch. The president will appoint a special prosecutor approved by the Senate who will investigate into what's been going on in the White House. Why not just allow the Attorney General and the Justice Department to do their job? That's whose job it should be.
The president gets to pick who investigates him?
Yeah, but why not let the Attorney General? I mean, wouldn't you investigating a crime within the government be something the Justice Department should be doing anyway?
Yeah.
Well, who was the Attorney General?
He was in on this stuff.
Yeah, John Mitchell. And while he was replaced by someone else, there was so much suspicion that the Attorney General and the Assistant Solicitor General and those people who work in the Attorney General's office are going to be so pro-Nixon, you're not going to get an honest investigation. So that's why they agreed to this compromise of creating a special prosecutor that the president still gets to appoint. And the person who was chosen was Archibald Cox. Well, it turns out Archibald Cox is such a relentless pursuer of the truth that Nixon has had enough of him and wants him fired. And so he orders the then existing Attorney General, got the names here, hopefully, it's Elliot Richardson, and what was the other name? Richardson and Ruckelshaus are the 2 people that were asked by Nixon to fire Archibald Cox, and they both refused, saying it's going to look bad. If you fire this guy, it's going to look like you're guilty as hell because he's finding out too much. And apparently Alexander Haig is sent to both of them and says, the president is involved in some very, very dicey dealings in the Middle East right now, and this is embarrassing the president and causing our foreign policy to be weak. You need to think of America and think of your president and do what's right and fire this guy. And they said, well, if the president thinks it's that important, he should announce himself that he wants it done. Well, they're fired. Both of them are fired. And a third person, Solicitor General, steps up and does the firing for them. Robert Bork. Who will Robert Bork come back to be later?
The nomination for the Supreme Court.
A Reagan nominee in the 80s. You know, super right-wing. So Archibald Cox is fired in what's called the Saturday Night Massacre. Because of not only was Cox fired, so were those other two first people, Ruckelshaus and Richardson, and their refusal to fire Cox. And he's replaced with a guy named Leon Jaworski. And Jaworski is just as dogged as was Cox. And so the investigation continues. And that's why those other two tapes are finally forced out of Nixon. So in late July,
Leon
Jaworski. The two tapes of the White House tapes.
Yeah, but what's
what we just talked about in the beginning about Nixon's voice 5 days after the break-in, helping to hope to get the hush money. Okay, in the very beginning of the, Nixon did not authorize the break-in in June of 72, but 5 days after the break-in, he was involved with Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Dean in trying to rustle up money to pay people off so they won't tell, cover it up. So when Nixon's voice is heard on the tapes discussing hush money, it is clear now that he's involved in obstructing justice in the cover-up. And that's when the Senate starts, or the House starts to move in the direction of drawing up impeachment articles. So in the summer of 73, after the final two tapes come out and it's clear that Nixon is involved in a crime, the House draws up impeachment articles. Nixon sends people to both the House and Senate to ask Republicans, which way are you going to vote on this? And almost all of them say, we're going to can you. It's just too obvious you're involved in a crime. So knowing which way the House, if they're going to draw up articles and the Senate will try and he will be convicted. His closest political allies in the Senate saying, yes, you have nowhere to go but out. On August 9th, 1974, at 12 noon, Nixon appears before the press. It's a tearful event. And offers his resignation. You know, you really ought to read the resignation speech. It's well crafted. It's amazing that a man who was under that kind of pressure and doped up as much as he was most of the time on drugs could write a speech that
coherent. What, doped up on drugs?
He wrote it.
He wrote it. Yeah.
How do you know?
It is said that the guy that does the Clear Eyes commercial did most of the writing for him.
The guy, Ben Stein.
Ben Stein did most of the writing for him.
He was a speechwriter.
He was a speechwriter. I mean, so was Patrick Buchanan.
I mean. Do presidents
Stein, I think, wrote the resignation, he wrote the structure of it, but it was Nixon's ideas.
Well, I think that's published right next to George Washington's farewell address. All books.
So he does. In fact,
how many presidents really wrote their own speeches?
I can tell you, the night before, on August 8th, the night before, a roommate and I were watching the news, and it said that Nixon made a comment that as of 12 noon tomorrow, he will be resigning. You can't believe the joy we had. We went out and bought six packs and sat around and waited for the actual resignation. And the feeling I had at noon, August 9th, 1974, was you can be as cynical as you want about the U.S. government. You can talk about how much the capitalist elite run over everybody and pull shenanigans and have people execute things. But when it comes down to it, the good guys won on this one. Evil was overturned on this one. And then what happened the next week?
He got pardoned.
Before everyone's trial. Pardoned before everyone's trial.
I don't understand how you can, if you can be pardoned before you're tried, why didn't he pardon himself before resigning?
That part's illegal. A president cannot pardon himself. It's in the Constitution.
That's what I needed to know.
Yeah.
If you are
accused of a crime, and you know you're innocent, and you take the pardon before you ever go to trial, what message does that send?
But has that ever happened before? I mean, or is
not anybody of that? The tapes had him saying it. Nobody of that statute had undergone that before.
Did they, like, play the tapes on CNN, Fox, and stuff, or was that not allowed?
There was no CNN or Fox.
It was the one, the television.
It was just the old three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC News. If you didn't, well, if you didn't catch it from 5:30 to 6, you had to wait 24 hours to catch it.
There
was no 9 on it.
Did they ever play any of the tapes?
A lot, and it was beautiful. Yeah, I was really excited about it. But I was so shocked by Ford's pardon. I couldn't believe it. And everybody believes that Ford, the next president, was lost re-election because of it. I wrote an editorial here after Ford's death there recently that Mr. Tate published. And it was about how Ford did a lot of good things, but that one wasn't one of them.
But why did he also that? Said that he did it because it's time for the country to...
Yeah, he said that we had been... First thing that was said after Nixon's resignation when Ford first took office was our long national nightmare is over. And then within, what was it, a few weeks when his pardon came or less, his explanation for giving the pardon was he just thought that the country needed to get back to the other businesses of solving the inflation problem and foreign policy, and that if we dragged on for another couple of years, dragging a former president through the news and the trials, that it would just hurt the country too bad, so it was best for the country. You know, prior to Nixon's resignation, I don't know if I was on the sheet here, I should have done this, it's in 1994. Agnew, Spiros T. Agnew, who was elected in 1968 and re-elected in 1972, a Greek-American former governor of Maryland, was accused of and convicted of accepting bribes and tax evasion when he was governor of Maryland. And he was forced to resign in October. In fact, it was October 8th.
Who was VP?
1973. He was Nixon's vice president.
That's how...
So Agnew had already resigned before Nixon did. Agnew was a person who was really strong on criticizing war protesters and hippies and talking about good, loyal Americans.
Is this the first time that you...
Good, law-abiding Americans don't protest the war.
Is this the first time you used the 25th?
Yes, this is what's going to happen here. In fact, the headlines when Agnew resigned was, Mr. Law and Order Falls. When I read that, I was in Japan at that time on a religious trip in October of 1973, and I looked at that and I said, one down, one more to go. We got him. Got him both. Those are magic days. So
they were elected.
Maryland.
Okay.
To
pardon?
Someone had to elect those people.
The silent majority is what Nixon used to call America. Don't listen to all those yippies and hippies and panthers and wolves. And it's the silent America that elected this administration. Well, let's think about this for a second. Before Nixon has to leave, if Agnew is out, somebody has to replace Agnew. You can't just wait till the next election like before. Now the 25th Amendment has to go into effect. So who was appointed and approved to replace Agnew as vice president?
Ford.
That's how Ford got to be vice president. He was not elected. He was House Minority Leader.
Because the majority was...
Well, you can select whoever you want to be a replacement vice president.
Oh, and Nixon...
There's no ascension.
Who gets to select?
Nixon selects and the Congress ratifies or certifies.
But if the president and the vice president go out at the same time, would it be the majority or minority?
Well, that would just be an elevation of whoever Speaker of the House would become president.
So it's the Speaker of the House, it doesn't...
But I think they'd have to select a vice president like they did for...
They don't do the same party? If it's a different party?
You remember the West Wing episode?
No.
Yeah, on the West Wing situation, Bartlett's vice president had resigned because of sex shenanigans. So there was no vice presidency, and they were waiting to fill that gap. And before they could fill that gap, Bartlett's daughter is taken captive by Middle East terrorists. And so therefore, he feels like he is not mentally able to be president while his daughter's captured. So he temporarily steps down, signs a letter like the 25th says. And the Speaker of the House of an opposite party, played by John Goodman, becomes temporary president. And so here is a temporary Republican Speaker of the House who's functioning as president.
I thought it was like seemed like a weird dream sequence when I got in halfway or something.
So there was a whole lot of, you know, what if type stuff going on in that West Wing episode, which fits this whole who becomes legally.
So the Speaker of the House is of the opposite party, they...
Yeah, they still become.
Yeah. I watched the greatest Mac episode last night.
it has nothing to do with this, since we're talking about our favorite TV shows and our history. It's about
how many TV shows?
About McCarthyism. Uh-huh. When they come and they tell them that Margaret's a Tommy's sympathizer. Cause
does it have Colonel Flagg in it?
What?
Does it have Colonel Flagg in it?
No, it's this guy named Williamson. Mm-hmm. And so he's a real jerk. And he's trying to blame Margaret. This is back when Margaret was like very strict about everything.
And that's the one where what's his name could have gone back to Tokyo? Charles Winchester?
No.
Oh, okay. It's Margaret Hopkins.
No, but it's the one where Klinger starts taking pictures on his camera and he wants to be a newsman. And so this guy tries to make a pass at Margaret and he gets a picture of it and they blackmail him. And he goes, I hope you all know you've been duped by a communist sympathizer. And Charles goes, you have too.
Yeah, that's a good one. That is a great one. MASH will make a lot more sense now that we've covered
the Korean War.
Korean War and also the politics of the time.
I had to answer questions based on a prompt about Chinese American women and their war efforts in World War II.
Is this in an English?
SAT. That's a lot of SAT today.
Sounds like some non-white male stuff going on here.
It's made by a college boy.
Chinese women.
I answer a bunch of math questions.
Mm-hmm. Today. Did you take both?
So therefore, after Ford becomes vice president and Nixon resigns, Ford becomes the president, and he's the first person to become president without having ever been elected to either the vice presidency or the presidency. So you can imagine that if you were...
What is the public vice
president? Like, there you go. If you were the president that became president through the accident of two steps here, wouldn't you want to try to be reelected to say that you truly was wanted by, were wanted by the public?
Mm-hmm.
So he ran against whom? And he lost against Carter. Is that on here?
It's not.
That's coming up in the next...
Rocket.
Either that or I just left it off.
I think it may be in 99.
It's number one of the next thing, of the next sheet. Let's talk about it because it is historically what's going on now and then we can come back. Well, before we get Ford out, let's do 895 on here. Once Ford becomes president, you've got to have another vice president. Who replaces him?
Rockefeller.
Nelson Rockefeller of New York.
Did Ford appoint him?
Yes. But when Ford ran for re-election in 76, he did not ask Nelson to be his running mate. He dumped him.
Nelson Rockefeller?
Yeah. The brother of Winthrop of Arkansas.
Is this the...
Or the uncle of the guy that just died here recently.
It's the rich person.
Mm-hmm. These are great. These are grandkids of John D. Rockefeller, the founder of the oil.
Now, wasn't John D. Rockefeller convicted of monopolizing? Isn't that a felony?
I don't know if he was or not. Yeah. I know Standard Oil underwent some legal proceedings as a result of the Sherman Act, but I don't know if John D. Rockefeller himself ever paid a fine or served time. Maybe he did.
Oh.
I think he was just forced to sell off holdings.
I'm maybe thinking of a different person. Did Nelson Rockefeller make like a bad mistake in a speech or something?
Is that what you're thinking of?
What?
A heckler? And I can't believe you know this. I had a copy of this for so many years and lost it. In front of the New York Times, he was giving a speech, and some heckler in the crowd started calling him names, and right in the middle of the speech, he went like that. And they caught the picture of the finger up in the air.
That's the most American thing you can do.
And they caught it. It was all over the front page.
With a blotch or something.
And when asked about it, he's pretty well, who cares, you know, like I'm running for president or anything. He's not going anywhere after this office.
That's not what I'm thinking of.
You're thinking of his personal life that turned out surprising at the end?
Well, I'm thinking of someone named else that has a name that starts with an R problem.
Oh, yeah. I've heard about that.
Wait,
rap song.
Before you say that,
apparently
can you tell us why
the vice president had a more modern lifestyle than we.
Oh yeah, I read that in Matt's book.
And yeah, I think he divorced his wife, and his final hours were spent with said acquaintance.
This isn't the Nelson Rockefeller.
Yes,
the recent one.
How did he die?
No, the recent one is an Arkansan whose father. Winthrop Rockefeller was brother of Nelson.
Did he die the way I'm thinking he died?
I don't know, but it's driving me crazy.
But
no, but I'm thinking of some guy that was like...
Bring it out, yeah.
He was at like a...
Keep going. Could a fly be so slow that you could catch him?
I know.
Haven't you seen karate?
No, at higher altitudes, flies are like this. They're like, they go so slow.
Well, anyway, back to our thing here.
But I was thinking about some guy that was at like,
God.
Okay, never mind.
Just we'll get to a Nash. Be quiet.
So where I wanted to go with this is in 76, Nelson is not asked to run with Ford. Who is? This person that you're looking for would later make commercials for Viagra and claim, my little blue friend. He did Pepsi commercials and Viagra commercials.
Really?
Is that who this is? This guy's hilarious as a person. He's fabulous. Bob Dole. Bob Dole, Senate Majority Leader, who ran for president against Clinton in 96, ran for vice president with Ford in 76, 20 years earlier.
Does re-elect have a hyphen?
I don't know.
I think it does a hyphen.
I don't know.
I wondered that the
whole
year.
Depends on how you feel.
Me too.
Like develop, have an E on the end of it?
Rayless, sure.
How about envelope?
Yeah, look,
how about tomato?
No.
It doesn't matter.
That's true. Well, during the Ford years, we talked about the win button, right?
Mm-hmm.
This occurs during Ford's years, and that is the fall of Vietnam that occurred in April of 75 that I mentioned. And it was Ford who made the decision as a president not to respond. The only response was to evacuate Americans and high-ranking Vietnamese officials from the embassy, rather than to restart the war. Now, there is also something that occurs within the same week that happens, a lot of people are not aware of. Cambodia took an American ship captive called the Mayaguez, and Ford sent in Marines to free the ship, and 60 Marines were killed in the freeing of the Mayaguez, and this is the same week as the fall of South Vietnam, or for the same month, I think. What was the voluntary failed program to fight inflation during the Ford years called? Whip inflation now buttons. When? The boat was called the Mayaguez. Mayaguez. It's like Mayaguez, the city in Cuba.
What?
You're looking for spelling. Here's something way out of place. Should have been much earlier. Kissinger's shuttle diplomacy. This is going on during the Watergate affairs. Kissinger went from Middle East country to Middle East country to Israel, trying his best to get a peace going on during the Yom Kippur War and afterward. And although not a lot was accomplished, probably because of Watergate's mess going on, Kissinger became a important, prominent foreign policy mover and shaker, and his shuttle diplomacy policy became a standard that future secretaries of state would pursue.
Well, what is?
It means to go from one capital to the next, trying to broker a peace by being an active leader of the peace movement. And he stays on as Secretary of State in Ford's administration, so he's a big, prominent person during Ford's years. 98, stagflation, talked about this the other day. It's important to know, it's been on the AP test. When you think about theoretical economics, what usually causes inflation to occur?
Lessening on profit.
Yes, but what market situations are causing prices to rise?
Inflate means more money's in.
More money's chasing after a limited number of goods. So when there's a growing demand pull inflation is usually the cause of inflation. And so if there's more and more people spending, rationally you could assume that what must be true about employment? Must be going up. That's why people have the money to spend, and the businesses are hiring more people to make things because they can sell it. So traditionally, inflation accompanies high employment. And traditionally, deflation or recessionary times parallel rising unemployment. But somehow, for the end of the Ford years going into the Carter years, poor guys, they experienced a situation where prices continued to rise, but unemployment fell through the floor. The worst of both worlds, runaway prices as well as high unemployment, and it got tagged stagflation, or stagflation. That's what 98 is. So the term stagflation is describing that situation. I've not seen SALT 2 on the test. In case it is, here's all we need to say. We don't have to go into all the steps here. I don't even understand all the steps. In fact, what you will notice these paragraph things from here on the next sheets, the 76 to 2000 period, and the paragraph thing in 99. These were not built from me building them out by memory. These are just copy-paste from that website, probably. So that's why they're so long. SALT II was a negotiation between... Why is there a two? I know why there is, because SALT I's and Nixon. Nixon and Brezhnev did SALT I. Brezhnev and Carter do SALT II in 79. First one's in 73, SALT I. Second one's in 79. First one's between Nixon and Brezhnev. Second one's between Carter and Brezhnev. It stands for Strategic Arms Limitations Talks. If I am correct, neither was ratified by the Senate, or the first one was and the second one wasn't. What these treaties call for are not reductions, but stop further building, put limitations on further building. So at the time, people criticized them for not doing a lot because they didn't reduce any. They do. It's the first time. In fact, SALT I, here's the way to ask this. This is the way to ask this. Compare SALT I and II to the Washington Naval Conference and the Kellogg-Briand Pact. You're not going to get that essay, but you sure could. Give us a chance to do a little reviewing that's important. Let's go back into the 20s and talk a second. What did the Washington Naval Conference provide?
Limiting on ships.
Five-power treaty, right? Yeah.
What is this?
The Washington Naval Conference of 1922 is when we did our pre-World War II studies. You may not have been with us. What did the Washington Naval Conference say about shipping in the five-power treaty?
They had to limit battleships to tonnage.
Go after somebody else.
Compared to other... It's like the U.S. and Britain and...
Italy, France. Japan, and France. They all would limit their shipping. Do you remember the ratio?
5-5-3-1-6-7-1-6-7.
The Brits and the U.S. got 5 million tons of shipping, et cetera. The Japanese got 3. The French and the Italians got 1.67. In so doing, we and the Brits had to reduce. We had to destroy some of our shipping. Japan got to build up.
Did we sell them stuff?
We destroyed our shipping, and Japan was able to build up more. I'm sure we sold scrap metal that helped them build it. And, of course, what happened in World War II? Japan attacked us, and so when we were attacked, we were fighting with a navy that was smaller, possibly because we had agreed to these limits, and being attacked by a country whose navy was larger. Why? Because we allowed it, we agreed to it. Now, don't comment on that yet, let's do this something else. The Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928, what did it do?
Didn't we give it to Britain so that we could get the
62 list? Nations do something.
It's that peace treaty that the France is like trying to strike a deal with us. Why don't we just invite everybody?
Right, so 62 nations, even if it starts out for cynical reasons, in the long run, Frank Kellogg tried to turn it serious, got 62 nations to sign a pact saying we renounce war as an instrument of foreign policy. So when you think about Pearl Harbor happening, how does the Washington Naval Conference, the Five-Power Treaty, and Kellogg-Briand look on December 8, 1941? Like we were idiots, like we were naive, like we trusted that negotiations and reductions of arms would bring peace. And what happens? The people we trusted attack us, sneak attack behind our back. We should have been what?
Okay.
Armed to the teeth. The only way to keep the peace is to be fully fortified, not by reducing arms, but by being ready and ready to fight back. Maybe they wouldn't have struck if we'd been bigger, was the thinking.
Carry a big stick.
So when you get into the Cold War, and we and the Russians from 40s onward, in the Cold War, 46 onward, start to build up all this nuclear arsenal. And some of those hippie radicals in the 50s, although they didn't exist yet, so they're beatniks, these beatnik radicals in the 50s start saying, we need to reduce arms before we kill each other. All this nuclear stuff's going to go off, and there'll be World War III, and there'll be no World War IV. What do people say to those people?
You're not patriotic.
You fool. Look at Kellogg-Briand. Look at Washington. Look at Japan and Pearl Harbor. The only way to stay safe against the Russians, the new enemy, is to be armed to the teeth. And so that nuclear arsenal grew between the two nations. And so did fears, and so did near catastrophes. Finally, in 72, for the first time, who? Richard Nixon, the commie chaser? What does he do in 72? Not only does he go to China to widen the Sino-Soviet split, but here he is agreeing with Brezhnev to a limitation of arms? Is Nixon the seasoned veteran anti-communist who knows what he's doing and finally seeing rationality, or is he the fool being duped?
I don't think that guy's ever been.
Well, there, that's what we're saying. That's where finally in 72 the mood came around, the fact that maybe we have to trust these Russians. And then in 79 we go even further under Carter's administration, SALT II. When is the first time we actually go to the point of saying we're not just going to limit, we're going to destroy and reduce? 1987 with Reagan, the INF Treaty. Reagan, the man who made his presidency on threatening the Soviet Union and the big buildup, agrees to the reduction. That's the irony of all this. Well, we're through with regular lecture. Now we're just going to pick and choose things from 76 to 2000 that might be there.
I didn't get that sheet.
Nor did I.
I handed them to Matt.
Oh, I didn't know I was handing those out. I had those already.
But everything from...
How many of
us? How many sheets are there? Three or four?
Three.
Three sheets. They go from 1 to 11, 12 to 28, and 29 to 46. And we're just going to pick out the key important points there.
All right. We need a gun.
I'll get it.
Fly?
Yeah. I'll get it.
It's Vietnam? The mosquito and the element?
I'll be right back. I'm going to be gone for like half an hour.
Are you really going to be right back? You're going to pull
really
L. Jones and claim you'll be right back and be gone for a couple of hours.
No, I really will be right back.
Okay, well, we'll just cover things that are on the task while you're
there. They had the chance to get out, man. I can't get out.
Because you're blocked?
It's freaking fly.
I'm going to catch that fly before we get started. Where is it?
Oh, I think we need to start the tape over for the next section because it's...
There were three sheets you said?